Hello, I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. I hope you enjoy this conversation from our 2020 podcast series.
Jingiwala, my name is Evelyn Araluen. I'm coming to you from Wurundjeri Woiwurrung country of the land of the Kulin Nations. Normally, I would like to acknowledge first and pay my honour and respect to the country upon which I am a visitor, and to always remember and remind of the responsibility that we owe to this place that has existed since before any of the languages and the structures that have been used to dispossess the peoples continuing to care for their country encountered this land. But today I'd also like to extend my respect and my acknowledgement to the Djaparong peoples and to their ongoing custodianship and care for their country, as we have recently heard the news of the destruction of the sacred women's trees in Djaparong country under Victorian Labor government in recent days. So I would like to use my acknowledgement as a reminder that sovereignty has never been ceded and that the ongoing injustice to the peoples of the Kulin Nation should not be accepted by the many people living on this country today. I'm really excited to be talking to an incredible mentor and leader in Aboriginal writing today, a really beautiful novelist who's got another incredible work to share with us all today after several other incredible works that many young people like myself have kind of grown into our own skills and our own powers reading. Tony Birch is the author of three novels, the best-selling The White Girl, winner of the 2020 New South Wales Premier's Award for Indigenous Writing and was also shortlisted for the 2020 Miles Franklin Literary Prize, Ghost River, winner of the 2016 Victorian Premier's Literary Award for Indigenous Writing, and Blood, which was shortlisted for the Miles Franklin Award in 2012. He's also the author of Shadowboxing and three short story collections, Father's Day, The Promise, and Common People. In 2017, he was awarded the Patrick White Literary Award. In 2021, he's got two more books coming out for us, a poetry collection, Whisper Songs, and a new short story collection, Dark as Last Night. Tony is also an activist, historian, and an essayist. Today, we are talking about the incredible novel, The White Girl, which was released last year. It's a really powerful novel that I think speaks to some of the experiences that are known only too intimately by pretty much every Aboriginal person living today. It's a story about different ways in which place continues to inhabit memory and the different injustices that affect the lives of Aboriginal people living today. It's a history that, set in the early 1960s, is not too far from the lives of many Aboriginal people today. I would like to begin my first question by actually reading the author's note, which is found at the end of this work. The White Girl is a fictional work set in a fictional town somewhere in Australia. The story of Odette Brown and her granddaughter Sissy is reminiscent of the experiences of many Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people throughout the 20th century, people of remarkable courage. I would not presume to tell the story of any child removed from family and community or that of the people left behind to deal with loss and the resultant trauma. What I do hope for with this novel is that the love and bravery conveyed by Odette and Sissy provide some understanding of the tenacity and love within the hearts of those who suffered the theft of their own blood. I dedicate The White Girl to both those who found their way home and, tragically, to the many who did not. Thank you so much for writing this book, Tony. I think it's something that's really valuable to see articulated in such a way and in such a space for many Aboriginal people today. Hello, how are you? And could you tell us just a little bit about why you came to decide to write about this incredibly painful part of all of our history?
Well, hello to you too, Evelyn. And I'm well, relatively well, considering what everyone's experiencing this year. I feel a lot of pain at the moment for what's happening in the Western District of Victoria in relationship to the destruction of important sacred sites, women's sites. So we're dealing with the trauma of that at the moment. I think it's relative to thinking about this book, because this book is a book which wants to both privilege the experience of Aboriginal women and Aboriginal girls in the case of Sissy. And the book was written with the express purpose of giving some understanding into the incredible courage of Aboriginal women to fight for their children and to fight to keep their children with family. And also that in regard to someone like Odette Brown, to tell a story of a very determined and dignified woman who literally is willing to fight with her own body to protect her granddaughter. And that is an experience that many Aboriginal people share. And in writing the novel, I wanted literally to write a story from the outset that would be putting an Aboriginal matriarch at the center of the book as a hero, or as a hero to our people.
I think that comes across really strongly. I mean, Odette is a woman who is in a lot of physical pain throughout the novel, which we see culminate in a way that I don't want to reveal too much of, but in a moment that had me so deeply terrified and anxious and stressed. And I think she's a character that you explore really beautifully, kind of as a metaphor of the ways in which women's bodies and the land that they are connected to carries so much trauma and so much violence, and has to walk through it and has to bear that suffering every single day. Was Odette inspired by any women that you knew, or did you really consciously try to avoid too specifically modeling different individuals in order to speak to kind of the universality of that experience?
Well, in a sense, she's both, because I think when you create a fictional character, and even if you look to real people as role models, and I certainly did with the book, ultimately you have to create a character who is three-dimensional on her own terms, so that, you know, Odette Brown is her own character, and she reflects the experiences of many Aboriginal women but is not simply a composite of those women. Having said that, I think the two issues that, or several issues that you already raised, it is about her spiritual and her physical body. And I'm very interested in, coming from a very big family of women, is that literally, when we talk about women putting their bodies on the line, we know that their bodies have to take a lot of physical punishment and need physical strength. And that punishment could be as a result of violence. It could be as a result of extremely hard work, and sometimes work in very slave-like conditions. And women who forego, I think, their own self-love at times to ensure that they're caring for others. So, as you indicated in the book, we know that Odette is experiencing really poor health, but there's no way that she is going to stop focusing on Sissy and Sissy's need and protection. And in a sense, that her own physical health is going to suffer because of that. And when you ask then, does it draw on real women, or are there real role models? Yes, of course there are. And I can take my mind back to the night that I published my first novel, or the launch of my first novel, Shadowboxing. And I was at the Fitzroy Town Hall in the reading room, and the front row had been reserved for my mum and all her old mates, who we call the Carlton crew, who are not the same Carlton crew who are sometimes in the media. And these were, a dozen or so women, Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal women, but all really tough women who'd grown up in really poor circumstances in the inner city. And when I looked out at them, and this is not a criticism, my mum would understand this, these women had fairly hard heads, you could see on their faces all of the difficulty they'd been through, all the struggles they'd made, and every struggle they made was for their children. And I said, involuntarily, these women would die for their kids, and they would, and they have. And not in that sort of, I don't want to relegate Aboriginal women to some sort of, women of the earth in the sense of that negative sense of women being part of nature. I think it's really demeaning. I mean, physically being tough and standing up for their kids. There's a wonderful poem by the African-American writer Alice Walker called Women. And there's a beautiful stanza where she writes, "These women have fists as well as hands." And it's such a an appropriate metaphor for the women I've known, because they have this, you know, open hand to protect and love their children with, and they have a fist, and they will use that fist to bang down doors or defend themselves. So I had those two analogies in mind. But I suppose it's important to say, Evelyn, at the outset, as well as thinking that I wanted, or knowing rather, that I wanted to write a novel of which Odette Brown was the heart of the novel, I also wanted to write a novel about love and tenderness, so that while the potential for violence is always on the periphery of the novel, and you said earlier, you know, your own sort of anxiety and tension in reading passages, you know, and literally what's going to happen to the to this woman and child, is that I wanted their love and expression of love to be at the centre of the novel, because I didn't want to write a book where Aboriginal women and their bodies were sort of some literary device to show pain and to show suffering. We know that Aboriginal women have suffered greatly, and it wasn't what I wanted to write about. I wanted to be very much a book of love in a very physical, tactile way. So there's a lot of physicality between women in the book, and that was quite overt.
Mm. I had the really beautiful experience of the second time that I read this. I listened to Sharina Clanton's Audible recording that you can – I really recommend that people I love the written page. I love what you do on the written page as well. But there was something incredibly powerful about having Sharina read this, and that's something that I think – that's a new part of your own writing practice as well, being able to have these recorded words be a part of the experience of the novel. So I really recommend that people listen to it. This is, I think, it's a story that deals so intimately with women, but it also does have constantly on the periphery and with the constant threat of puncturing that tender, loving safety that Sissy and Odette, her grandmother, share. There's a lot of destructive and destroyed men always sort of hanging around, and you deal with a particular kind of poor, miserable white masculinity in a very, I think at times sympathetic, and then at other times I think deeply, horrifically cognizant of the perpetuating violence that that communities like this in this period, and still many communities today, are just plagued by, as much as they are plagued by the environmental destruction of whiteness and its associated institutions. How did you feel, you know, you've never shied away from the fact that you came from a really working class background, and you know, you grew up in Fitzroy, you grew up in an inner city suburb, writing about the bush, writing about a country town, writing about this town of Dean, how did you bring together the images of this place and that violent periphery, and how did you balance that with everything you've just spoken about, that beautiful tenderness and that intimacy between Sissy and Odette, alongside the horror of this landscape, and a landscape that is so often troped and kind of exploited by Australian literature? You chose to do something, I think, really different with this. What was your process with that?
I mean, you are right. I've spent all my life in the inner city of Melbourne. I've rarely crossed Bell Street and Preston unless I'm catching an aeroplane. But so that I am a really inner city boy, and have, you know, and I really love the exploration of both being Aboriginal and working class, and, you know, friends of mine, we talk about this quite a lot. I think the understanding of how the Australian landscape, whether it be urban or rural or so-called remote in a European sense, I don't think, because of my background of doing a lot of research in history and someone who's read widely and really looking at something like film culture, I have a very strong belief in the way that, you know, all sorts of landscapes impact on people's psyche. So that if we think about the colonial notion of, you know, terra nullius of exploiting land for capitalist and colonial gain. I mean, from my work as an academic and thinking even about the work I've done in climate justice, it's not difficult to join the dots about the relationship between the destruction of country and the destruction of people. I had, Evelyn, written earlier when I was working as a historian about the way that the failure of colonial agriculture had a real detrimental effect on the European psyche. So to put it into sort of to sharpness, if you think about the fact that, you know, very poor families living on land and which was supposed to be enriching, was supposed to be in colonial society wealth, and the way that that wealth would be advanced would be the murder of Aboriginal people. So we know that the land has suffered greatly, and we know that, in fact, that the colonial project has failed, but people can't admit to it. So in context of that in the novel with the Cain family, they are a failure as a colonial story, a pioneer story, and their resentment about failing is also overlaid with a haunting of violence, of which is encapsulated in land. So, in other words, they are both bitter about their own experience, and they are affected very deeply by the blood that is in land. So that it's not surprising at all that they react the way they do, in particular one of the sons and the father. I felt that was quite appropriate. I suppose the other characters where it was thinking about how is that history and that psychological trauma going to affect different people. And if we take the two policemen, for instance, Bill Shea, who is the town policeman and the town drunk, he's someone who racism has really destroyed him. He's someone who grew up amongst Aboriginal kids. And then as an adult, as a policeman, either stood by or was involved in the removal of children. And his self-disgust and self-loathing is such that the only way that he can cope is to drink heavily. And then ultimately that destroys him. And then you have someone like Sergeant Lowe, who is the new policeman in town, who is quite in some ways a pathological figure. But if I've been a bit disappointed, it's the way that some white critics don't understand that. They think that he's not a fully composed character. In other words, he must have his soft side that I should have shown. He's macrame making of a night, or I don't know, doing crayon drawings with his children. I think what colonial violence does is that it affects people in different ways, and there are men in Australian history, in colonial society, who committed gross crimes against Aboriginal people, and they never reconciled from that. And these are men who went to their grave believing that whatever punishment Aboriginal children had suffered, whatever punishment and violence Aboriginal women had suffered, it was for the betterment of the nation. And Sergeant Lowe is indicative of that. He's quite callous character, but one that I dealt with as much responsibility as any other character. And then there is someone like Henry Lamb, who is Odette Brown's lifelong friend, and he's a much more sympathetic character. But also, I'm really strong believer in the idea of emotional intelligence. And you know that I taught in universities for decades, and I met people who had great intellectual capacity but no sense of empathy, no ability to emotionally engage with Aboriginal people. And Henry, although he would be described as soft or slow, because he has such an emotional warmth towards Odette, he can't even comprehend why anyone would treat her with racism. So I didn't want to write a book where just all the Aboriginal people are good and all the white people are bad. And Henry, there's hope in a character like Henry. And the other male character that I introduced to this was the Dr. Singer, the Jewish doctor. And I did that not so much because, he's a Holocaust survivor, although that comes out when you see how dismissive Lowe is of his own experience, is that the Dr. Singer character was created to try and introduce readers into an understanding of what it would mean for an Aboriginal woman even to see a doctor. So we know that Aboriginal women go their whole lives, or did before Aboriginal health services were set up, dedicated health services, their whole lives of not seeing a doctor because of the shame, because of going to a doctor and leaving that doctor surgery without their own children, of being really demoralised by that. And when Dr. Singer asked Odette Brown to remove her dress, just her dress, her outer clothing garments. It's in today's sort of world that would be seen as mild, but the very fact that he's a white man and an Aboriginal woman in a room where she's asked to take part of her clothing off, I wanted to show in that scene and in that relationship, even though he's a minor character, here is a man who did treat her with dignity. And again, it's important to show people there are other ways to be in the world. And I think Singer and Henry Lamb represent a different way of, you know, non-Aboriginal people thinking about and having interactions and relationships with Aboriginal people.
So I actually find that one of the most powerful characters in this entire story for me was Henry Lamb and this this deep care and intimacy of exile and different forms of exile. And something that I think you gesture to quite a lot is the different ways in which narrative has to cover up or conceal or be employed so strategically for protection. And we see this with Sissy. I think this is kind of implied by the title, but we see this a lot with the way in which Odette is struggling to find a safe place in the world for her granddaughter, particularly after her experiences with her own daughter and, you know, what we eventually find out happened there and her struggle to feel capable of providing that safety. Henry is somebody who is just so uncomplicatedly caring and compassionate for these people that he's grown up around, and the exile that he experiences is something that I think any reader will react with, you know, a lot of empathy and sadness for. I think quite a deep sadness for. So he really came through to me as just one of these incredibly powerful characters. But these little stories and these little pockets of story of ostracization, of alienation, of different working class rural experiences, and then the different ways in which Aboriginal people were forced to protect themselves with changing stories, I think adds to the complexity of so many Aboriginal people living today trying to piece our histories back together. You really showcased a number of different experiences there, from the kids who only exist now in terms of the way in which their Aboriginal identity is remembered and honoured through a photograph that Odette takes the responsibility for carrying. You know, you have Wanda, who works at the hotel, who is just desperate to see her own mother in every Aboriginal person who walks through the room. How did you piece together so many of those different narratives? And a more personal question on that, was that difficult, and was that a painful experience for you? You know, we're both people who've had experiences of dislocation and removal in our family, and I found so many of those moments just so on the nose and so hard to bear. So why was it important for you to bring some of those different stories in? You know, why did you want to showcase such a range of the different ways in which Aboriginal people are forced to conceal themselves, particularly in that period? And what was that experience actually like for you as a writer and as an Aboriginal person?
Well, there's a lot there. One of the first things I'd say is it doesn't surprise me, but you're the first person to ask me about the photographs, about Dolores' photographs. And no non-Aboriginal person has brought that up in any conversation or review. And I think for Aboriginal people, the photographs of children that we've lost or even those who returned home many years later, they're incredibly haunting, because when Odette is handed those photographs, she doesn't want them. And the reason she doesn't want them, she doesn't want to take on the responsibility of being the custodian or even the sort of adoptive mother of even more kids that have been taken. But at the same time, she can never get rid of the photographs, and in the end accepts that those memories, the faces of those children, need to be held by her and Alma, Jack's wife. And that to me is really important, because that is both an expression of the love that Aboriginal people have for those who were taken, but also the burden. And when I say a burden, I don't mean the burden of loving your own children. Is what these women and what these men are doing is they're burdened by colonial violence, because we live in a society where white colonial violent acts are repressed. and there's a great need to repress and erase them from the psyche of the nation. So Aboriginal people, we are required to carry the memory of white people as well. So we don't just carry our own memory. We have to carry their memory of colonial violence, because if we didn't do that, it would be forgotten. So I sometimes think that when you see older Aboriginal people and how much they've suffered with this, I think sometimes they'd love to forget, you know, just forget and have a cup of tea and have a day that's not haunted by this past, but they know they have a terrible burden and responsibility to do so. So that was key. In regard to the difficulty of writing this, there's only one passage in this book that I found, when I say difficult to write, that I got quite upset and I can't read the passage. Well, I have, but it's a real struggle. And that's a simple paragraph when Wanda, who is a woman who is also taken from her family as a very young child, when she meets Odette Brown, she thinks initially that Odette Brown could be her own mother. And in fact, what we realize is that every time Wanda sees an older Aboriginal woman, she has this fantasy that it could be her mother. And then she asks Odette Brown for a hug because she wants to save her both the psychological and the physical emotion of that act. And you know, she holds onto Odette's body and she smells her and she feels the strength of Odette. That is a very, very difficult passage for me to read, but that's the shocking reality of many Aboriginal kids taken from family who were never hugged, were never given any love, and the absence of love in their life includes the ability to be touched and held by matriarchs, you know, by old Aboriginal people. So that I found that quite tough, but also quite necessary. In relationship to my own life, it's not the same story, but is that, yeah, like any other family, we have gone through the experience in our family of people spending many, many years in institutions of children, in prisons, in youth detention. I've had family members murdered. I've lost family members to for different forms of abuse. And what I would think in this book, I didn't put any of that into this book because, again, as I said earlier, I didn't want it to be a book burdened with that level of sadness. I think it is a book where there is great sadness. I think, you know, when Dolores, we hear the story of Dolores and what happened to her children, that's gut-wrenching to hear that. And that's one of those moments in the book where that needed to be told. And toward the end of the book, when we understand the relationship between Sissy and her own mother, Lila, how that plays out is something that is also it's very sad. And I think we have to accept if we're writing a story about stolen children, we can't write a fairy tale. It is a book about love, but it's not a fairy tale. We know that some Aboriginal people have been reunited with family, and we know that some haven't. And we know that those who have been reunited with family, it's still a very difficult process. So because of the intergenerational trauma associated with such violence, you know, you can't expect that when families reconnect and reunite that it's simply going to be easy, because the scars that people carry are lifelong scars. So there are a couple of reflections of that in the book as well.
I think those reflections and those sorts of moments where you do see people, Aboriginal people, who have clearly been incredibly scarred, and also this idea of possibility that always exists in different characters. We have moments in which I think you leave the identity of some characters or their ancestry a little bit ambiguous, because that is, again, indicative of the reality of these communities, these spaces, and this history, this shared settler colonial history that is so violent and so interested in its own reimagining constantly. Mm. And this stage is exactly how a story gets reimagined and exactly why, which I think is so crucial. But one of the things that struck me that I think you pulled off so well in this is the complete and utter unpredictability of how any character will react to Odette or to Sissy. There is never any stability in how they will be received or perceived in their environment. And as the reader, we're so nervous about different moments in which Sissy is desperate to reveal her connection to her grandmother. She's desperate to be able to speak proudly, you know, you are my relation, I am your granddaughter, and other moments in which we as the reader just know she needs to conceal that, and she needs to hide that that reality for her own safety. You've kind of given us a really incredible cross-section of just the entire unknowability of an Aboriginal life in the 60s in different environments, and that necessity of concealment and of sort of strategic manipulation of identity that's only an option for some people. We do see that, and I think you do really deal with that very beautifully. But I wanted to ask you a little question around the way in which those legacies and the kind of the impact of the identities that we have to construct ourselves into for safety or for whatever purposes, particularly around this character that you mentioned before of Sergeant Lowe. So I just wanted to read a section of a conversation between Dr. Singer and Lowe that I think embodies the volatility of the institutional system, of the protectorate system, and also of this character, Lowe, who is awful and despicable. And I'm furious that any reviewer expected that you owed a nice white protector for the reader. That is just the biggest, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. So to give a sense of why that would be a ridiculous expectation, I just want to read this section. Lowe looked at the tattooed number on Dr. Singer's arm. "You are new to this country. I believe you are a Jew." "Yes, I'm Jewish. The native people of this land are agitating for the rights of citizenship. I've actually heard one of their speakers claim that they have suffered as the Jewish people suffered during the war," Lowe said. "In my experience, both here and in Europe, it only does such people harm to dwell," he added. "Why is that?" Dr. Singer asked. "You do not believe people suffered, Sergeant Lowe?" "Only as much as we all suffer through life," Lowe said, looking directly at the doctor. "There's nothing particularly noble in casting oneself as a victim. I firmly believe there is courage in silence." And this is the attitude that still pervades today, and it's the attitude that still burdens Aboriginal people today. And you've tackled it head on in the wake of the still unanswered questions and demands of the Bringing Them Home report, in the wake of this continuing dispossession of Aboriginal people from their families, you know, the continued removal of Aboriginal kids through the welfare system. Why was it important for you to write this book now?
Well, I think you've addressed a few of the issues in that little snippet, and I think that one is I wanted people to understand the history, the complexities that Aboriginal people live with every day. So, in other words, you talked about the uncertainty that Sissy and Odette face, and what I wanted to highlight was, one, that all of the legislative controls of Aboriginal people, particularly around identity and movement, were contradictory, complex, and hypocritical. So, in other words, the only certainty that Aboriginal people knew is the uncertainty around control of their lives, and that control of their lives could change at the whim of someone like a police sergeant who really could administer summary justice. So one thing that we know in the town of Deane is if we have a rather sort of hopeless policeman like Bill Shea in charge, yeah, it's not hard for him to turn a blind eye because he's blind drunk, you know. And Aboriginal people, in a relative sense, can get on with their lives with this neglectful policeman in town. But then when you get this officious, pathological Sergeant Lowe come to town, he is hell-bent on reasserting control over Aboriginal people, and that is a very damaging outcome. So I wanted to highlight the deep violence of legislation, so that when people talk about frontier violence, they think about only physical violence. And I've written for many years now and given talks for many years about the psychological and physical violence that comes out of legislation. So a lot of the deaths of Aboriginal people in custody, you can look back over their lives and see legislation as something that formed who they were. The second one that you alluded to there was about sort of what strategies people may adopt to survive these acts. And I think it's absolutely shameful the way that the identities of Aboriginal people are questioned today, particularly obviously people who don't fit some essentialist stereotype, but not only. You know, you could be an Aboriginal person with very dark skin, you put a suit on and someone will tell you you're not real. So there are many ways that you're disenfranchised. So it's not just about skin colour, but the way that younger generations in particular of Aboriginal people are denied their right to be who they are because they don't fit some physical stereotype. And I think that's a continuation of that violence. And, you know, if it needs to be said, when that comes at times from within your own communities, I think it's even worse. And it's one of the issues that really that I'm often need to discuss with people to give people understanding. If they really understood this history, they would know to question someone's identity because of their skin colour is ludicrous, because people were targeted as Aboriginal people because of their skin colour. They weren't excused because of their skin colour. They were just identified as another type, you know, another category. And the other issue would be, it is in, again, regard to my great and respect for Aboriginal women, that, you know, I knew that there was an incredible deep responsibility of writing a novel, even though it's third person, that the central characters are a 60-year-old Aboriginal woman and a 13-year-old Aboriginal girl. I did feel a deep, deep responsibility in conveying the lives of these fictional characters. And by the way, no one has said, yeah, you shouldn't do that, but people have asked me, oh, was that difficult? It wasn't difficult in the sense that I could, you know, I could develop those characters and those voices, and partly because I've been surrounded by women like Odette, and partly because I've got four daughters who were all 13 at one stage of their lives. And so I have a great, you know, I have a great experience of being around a lot of women and girls, children. But I felt if I wanted to convey how powerful Odette was, how I wanted people to love her and respect her. And Evelyn, if someone said what was the most important outcome you hope for this book, I hope that people respect Odette Brown and love her and be really in awe of her. And that was never in any doubt. So it's not like when I started the novel, I thought, well, I don't know where I'll end up with Odette. She could turn out to be an axe murderer, you know. She was always going to be the hero of this book. And I have really, I've really enjoyed the fact that people who have enjoyed the book, my readers, both Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people, particularly women, older women, they've loved her and enjoyed her too. I think there is some cross-cultural value here, that if the book is if there is an act of sort of wanting to reach out for a discussion here, I think you have a good hook, so that all older women, you know, who read this book, Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal, and think about the value of relationships, I want them to say, we shouldn't have to prove that we love our children. You don't have to ever prove that. And the fact that I show that love between Odette and Sissy, I hope that readers see that as natural and they question any doubt they had about Aboriginal women's love for family, because one of the shocking lives of the Stolen Generations history, which came out after the release of the 1997 Bringing Them Home report, was the shocking comments by conservative politicians and media in Australia that Aboriginal women had given their children up willingly to the state, and that Aboriginal women felt that their children would be better off if they weren't in their own care, and that they couldn't give them the same love and attention that the state could. Now, that is a shocking indictment, and the fact that anyone should consider we have to prove that we love our children is a human rights abuse, and I hope that through the book any notion that would be questioned would be put to bed.
I think it's, you know, for a start, Odette is every Black woman who's ever taught me and loved me and cared for me and been there in ways that, as a young person, you know, and you know, you meet a character like Odette, you don't tell us the full story of Odette, you don't tell us the full story of her life and how she lived it, and we know things about, you know, loss of many of her family members, and we know so much of her love for her daughter and for her granddaughter. But there are plenty of points, I think, that you keep to her own, you know, to her own intimacy and privacy of her memory. But you certainly don't shy away from alongside that deep, insane love, the kind of love that is, pushing a woman to leave herself in extreme pain simply so she can find a safe potential for her granddaughter. You do also show a mother who suffered greatly at the hands of white masculinity and white violence. You show a mother who exists throughout a lot of the novel as a sort of a hope, a promise, but simultaneously the potential of another loss, another unnamed grave, which you have a beautiful scene. You have a beautiful scene about the graveyard that will stay with me forever. Why did you include that part as well? And why did you include those people who don't come home and this unfortunately all too common story of those who were left behind for whatever reason or another?
Oh, look, it's to, I suppose, address the reality that some children never come home. And we often, in the stories of the Stolen Generations, rightly so, focus on the children who were taken. But I'm also interested in the absence that was experienced for life by those who were left behind, who never saw their kids again. And it's often played out, as in this novel, through the physical objects that hold memories of people who never come back, so that you know early in the novel that Odette often looks up at the wall of a photograph of her daughter taken when she was 16. And I have published a poem which is also in the new collection called Away, which is about mothers, you know, what they're left with when children leave. And, you know, that could be a photograph, it could be an old toy, or it could be, in my poem, it's about, you know, the finger marks on a doorway of a sort of smudged childhood, you know, finger marks of a kid with Vegemite fingers. And one of my mother's brothers was murdered when he was 18, and it's something that struck me from a very young age, that when my mum would miss her brother, she would get this little case out from under her bed and open it, and all his stuff was in there, photographs, a shirt, a breadboard that he made in Pentridge Jail himself when he was 17 years old. And she would literally sniff the shirt, you know, pick up the breadboard, and it's trying to conjure his life to bring him back into being. And that, to me, is that relationship between what is left when someone doesn't come back, and that, again, when we think about the experience of Aboriginal people who have lost kids to institutions or family members to institutions of various sorts, you know, whether it be the justice system or through the Stolen Generations, is that all our families mourn someone who has never come home. And again, I didn't want a fantasy, a sort of a Hollywood ending, and I wanted a realistic ending, but one that was still an ending. You know, and I suppose, again, Evelyn, it's balancing that I really enjoy the ending, and I think it tells, again, about the deep love between Sissy and Odette and someone like Millie Kahn, who we haven't talked about, but who's such a wonderful character. And that I think, is the, in other words, it's a fictional truth and it's a factual truth that we could ask the question. And, you know, I have five children and I'm so lucky to have all my five children and my two grandchildren around me. The notion that one of my children would not be around me, or one of my grandchildren would be taken from my family, it's so horrific to even contemplate that it frightens me to think about it. And yet I know women that has happened to them. So as much as the sadness in their life, I sometimes wonder, how did they keep going? How are they still here? And the reason is because the only reason I can deduce is that they have other people around them and they still have the capacity to find love. So, and that's what we do. We don't give up, because there are other people in our lives who care for us and we also need to care for. So, you know, ultimately, it speaks about the great strength and tenacity of Aboriginal people. And I'll say this, I've never met an Aboriginal person that doesn't have a remarkable story to tell, any person. So when you meet an Aboriginal teenage kid for the first time and they might start talking about family, and I don't mean tragic stories, I mean just great stories. You think, these people are amazing. And I just think that I'm part of a community of amazing people, and people who really can look you in the eye and be honest with you, because they've been through so much, and they've come out of it, you know, sometimes very sad, sometimes suffering, but still together in some way. So I think that, again, it's about ultimately you're asking a question, I think, that's really important about the difficulties of our experiences. I think you're really onto something, and my response, which I've only just thought of now because I haven't been asked these questions before, they're great questions, is that I wanted to address all of the issues that are important to us, including those ones of sadness, but do it with a sense of dignity. So I wouldn't want any Aboriginal person to read the book and feel that they had been dealt with, or a similar experience to theirs was not dealt with dignity, in a dignified manner. And that you read that passage about being victims before. I'm really appalled when I hear this idea, Aboriginal people, you can't see yourselves as victims all the time. Yeah, stop claiming victimhood. I think it's so disparaging, because all I want to say is, what are you suggesting, that people haven't suffered? This is not about claiming victimhood. It's about incredible suffering that you are responsible for. And I've never met an Aboriginal people who wants to play on the notion of being a victim. I've met a lot of Aboriginal people who have suffered greatly and have great dignity in their own lives. So it's another abuse of our communities when those sort of accusations are thrown at people. You had to say an Aboriginal woman, you're living in a culture of victimhood, when that woman's child or grandchild has been taken from her. I can't think of a more violent thing to say to a person. So, again, I knew I was going to be sort of touching on that sort of story, and, again, to do it in a way that all of the women in this book have a great sense of power and dignity about them.
I think the dignity as well, even for those who, as one character we find out, chose to stay away and found the possibility of reconnecting too much. And it was something that we see the story as showing, still extending humanness to and great dignity and respect for, with the basic fact that there are just some things that are too violent and too horrible to do to a human, to expect the happy ending, to expect the healing. And there are, you know, the novel describes not only those characters who couldn't find their way back, those characters who didn't want to, but also, and you mentioned Millie, the characters who wait. And they might not be waiting for their kids back. They might not be waiting for this resolution to the all too familiar narrative that so many of us have gone through, of that removal and that separation. But people who, you know, Aboriginal people and Aboriginal women who stayed on their land, who stayed to connect to their land and who wait. And we have this incredibly beautiful scene that I don't want to speak too much on because it kind of reveals the end of the novel, and we don't want spoilers. But there is just this one incredibly gorgeous bodily gesture that Millie gives at the novel's close, just about the ways in which waiting is an extension of that responsibility and that custodianship to the land as well, and holding place and holding that knowledge and that ceremony. And this Millie's a character who, like, she bought her land back, like she chose to buy her land back, which in the 60s is like such a powerful symbol. And I love her because she seems like she's this liminal character who is in one way or another kind of able to escape the worst of it, but is still marked by this otherness and this this externality of the Aboriginal person in a small country town in the 60s. And the other thing that you kind of deal with, sort of connected to that, is the other characters who do find their way outside of the act, and they find their way of getting some autonomy at the cost of this ability to fraternize. And you talk about the exemption certificates, which is such a dirty, dark word in our histories, and it's something that a lot of blackfellas don't like talking about. why did you write about the exemption certificates? And was that, I want to ask if that was challenging too.
No, I think it would have been challenging if I wrote about, so Jack Haynes, who's gone for exemption, I think I would find it challenging if I wrote about him negatively. And I didn't want to do that because I think, well, there are several things, is that you're never exempt from being an Aboriginal person. And as we find with Jack, he has the exemption certificate. He proudly boasts that he has it, and then he's treated like a child by a policeman at a railway station. So he's put right back in his place as an Aboriginal person. And that's important for me to talk about historically, because there's no such thing as an Aboriginal person becoming non-Aboriginal. It's not possible, because even if you carry it with you, all Aboriginal people who have been exempted either by choice or not. So most of the legislation, by the way, around identity, Aboriginal people were re-legislated as non-Aboriginal without choice, overwhelmingly. The same people who had legislated to treat you as non-Aboriginal certainly didn't treat you as a white person, and they would put you back in your place as soon as they felt a need to, and sometimes legislatively back in your place. So it's so hypocritical that you could be identified as Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal throughout your life several times because of a legislative whim. So in that sense, with Jack, I didn't want to demean Jack. I wanted to show the hypocrisy of a system that puts these exemption certificates in place. And also that I hope through the interaction that he has with Odette and how he acts later on in the novel, that not only do we value him as a character, but we understand that these issues are very complex. So, you know, any of us who want to make a judgment, well, if we do make judgments about people who either passed or people who were exempted, I think from where we're sitting, it's very easy to make that decision, and I don't think we're entitled to make that judgment. And I would go further, and that is that when you consider Aboriginal people who were having their children stolen from them, people who adopted so many different strategies as a means of survival, and if that strategy meant passing, well, if a woman had to do that, I would only compliment her for trying to do the best she could. And a lot of people didn't do it officially, but they did it by other means, so that a wonderful Aboriginal matriarch, Torres Strait Islander from Darnley Island, Eleanor Harding, who was a great mentor to me as a younger person, she told me once that if a number of Aboriginal women were living in a boarding house in Fitzroy and they might have their own kids in one or two rooms, another Aboriginal woman would have another couple of rooms, if the welfare board turned up to visit one of the Aboriginal women so that she knew she had an Aboriginal woman with children in the house, they would say to that woman, "Don't you tell her I'm Aboriginal," or they might even move out of the house because they didn't want to come under the attention of the welfare board. So all the time, yeah, they might be on the run, they might be denying their identity occasionally, but that's because it's a means of survival for their children. That is what they are doing. So that I think generally what we need to know about this history is the level of destruction that it causes to the Aboriginal individual and the Aboriginal family unit. And there is no judgment to be made about Aboriginal people around this legislation in a negative sense. What we're talking about is cruelty. This is bastardry and cruelty. And it humiliated people, attempted to destroy people. And in my academic life, I would be able to say, and I could show you this through documentation or your listeners rather, is that the legislation that was established to create these various caste acts were legislative acts of extermination. They state overtly about a need to make the Aboriginal race extinct. So we're talking about people wanting and needing to survive genocide. And, you know, to quote Malcolm X, yeah, by any means necessary, you survive as best you can. And we are in no position to make a negative judgment of that, no position. Aboriginal or non-Aboriginal people, we need to understand that people were literally fighting for their lives, their physical lives and the lives of their children. Having said that, overwhelmingly, the majority of Aboriginal people did not pass, nor could they pass, because they had been so closely monitored and didn't get exemption certificates. I think there are about 2,000 exemption certificates granted in Queensland during the whole period of that legislation, which is about 60 years. So most Aboriginal people, it's not even a course of action that they could consider because people are bureaucratically institutionalised even if they're living in a country town.
And it's also now, I think, one of the ways that some families, it's the only way that people have these records and this documentation. And there is a scene that that we just get a glimpse of, which is never resolved, where Odette sees this huge stack of files and she's told that that's her. She's told that this is all of the documentation and everything that's written about her. You know, it's one of the many moments that Odette is externalized out beyond herself as like a product. You know, that she sees this little shop of the cards that she's painted and sold to this white lady to be sold to the public, and the lady doesn't even recognize her in that space as the artist. And this externality of identity in documentation that you as a historian, you know, that's the work that you've done. You deal with records, you deal with these archives of memory that so often are, you know, they replace the actual oral stories of that and the oral memories of that history. And I think you deal with it really beautifully in the novel. What I love about this novel is that it just paints a picture of a period and of a set of circumstances that would be so typical for a number of different Aboriginal families living today, whether or not we have the documents or the direct stories of it. This is what's underneath the experiences of a lot of people, and it's really not that long ago. You know, we're talking about the 1960s. This is, for many people, you know, within a living memory. I wanted to pivot a little bit to kind of another one of the broader aspects of your career and your life's work, your commitment to awareness and climate justice and to the cause of addressing the impact of colonial violence on the landscape and the work that we all need to do in order to prevent further climactic catastrophe. Now, you're writing a book in the 1960s, and it's obviously at a time in which it wasn't publicly known the devastating effects, things like global warming and such, that we would, you know, in a few decades be aware of. But the picture that you give us in this story is of an Aboriginal community that is deeply and intimately aware of the impact of settler coloniality on the climate and on the environment. So I wanted to just read a little bit of a conversation between Odette and Sissy, where Sissy has just said to her grandmother how much she wishes she could go swimming and how much she wishes she could be swimming in the dry river in Dean. Odette laments, "The fish and eels would be swimming with us, the old people. They knew the river and its stories from the time it had run free. All along this way, the water overflowed into the old billabongs. Now all we have is the muddy bottom and the frogs," Odette said. "There's hardly a drop of water left for them." "What happened to all the water?" Sissy asked. "Tell me that story." "There's not much to tell. White people got even greedier than we thought possible. That's what happened." Over the years, Odette had witnessed local government officials seizing more and more land and then filling in old billabongs and covering the muddy ground with screening from the mine before selling off the land. "Between the farmers and the politicians, we were left with nothing. Our people have been hurting since," she said. How important was it for you, in the broader context of this work that you do to support climate justice, how important was it to you to make that awareness and that historical awareness of the impacts that we're now seeing as an unavoidable truth visible in a country town in the 1960s?
Well, it's interesting that people do think about the degradation to ecology and the environment as a recent issue. Obviously, one of the issues about talking about this in the 1960s was that not only to highlight the destruction of the time, but how it occurred. So in a town like Dean, it occurs because natural wetlands like billabongs are being filled in and the land is being sold off as quickly as it could be. And that, in fact, is a phenomenon in Western Victoria, which began in the 19th century. And I, in my work as a historian, I looked into a place which is called, by the way, Lake Lonsdale outside of Stawell. It's an artificial lake that was created when a dam was built there, and it destroyed the natural wetlands of the area, which is Jadwajali country. The salinity became an horrific contributor to ecological destruction, and this is much earlier. So that I read stuff from the 1930s when there's a very strong awareness of the environmental destruction that's occurring as a result of destructive agricultural practices, the destruction of Aboriginal country, and the harvesting of water. So we're now, you know, in 2020, thinking we have this problem to deal with that we have only faced in recent decades. Now, while global warming is a phenomenon that we've only been aware of, you know, strongly for about 40 years. What we need to know is that people who are destroying Aboriginal country by running single crop agriculture or by running sheep and cattle on country, there were critiques of this practice in the 19th century. And what I would argue is that it's what capitalism always does in relationship to the exploitation of country. It's just get the next year's crop in. Yeah, let's get the next bumper harvest and then let's feed some chemicals into the land and get another year. There is what is clear here, Evelyn, is the relationship or the contrast between deep time, Indigenous deep time, and what we might call capitalist tomorrow time. Yeah, what can we have tomorrow? What can we have today? You know, everyone's going faster and faster and we need money now. We need money now. There's no sense of genuine custodianship of land. So what we know is that in the novel, in the 1960s, the river has been really pretty much basically destroyed. But there is a pivotal scene in the novel after Odette confronts old Mr. Kane about the violence that her daughter had suffered, and she walks back to town along that riverbed, and she is really suffering physically, but is hearing the old river, hearing the old voices, hearing the old people, that strengthens her enough to get back home. And that was relative to work I've done a lot around what we might call, you know, the Birrarung Lower Yarra Basin, where I've always been fascinated by the age of the Birrarung River and the fact that the original bed of the Birrarung River, which is about 100 metre depth just outside Port Phillip Heads, is still there. So as much as we look at the port today and it's an artificial construction, it again destroyed a lot of wetlands around what people would call areas like South Melbourne today, Port Melbourne. These were wonderful Wurundjeri and Bunurong wetlands. I know that old river is still down there. It's still flowing underneath the bay. So part of it is to say, even though this river is near killed, it is not dead. And I think that one of the issues that I get sustenance out of, if Aboriginal people were given control of country, the most degraded country, Aboriginal people can bring country back to life and rejuvenate country. So there is still there is still potential for country to live. It's just a matter of white society getting out of the way, stop thinking about exploitation of land and really thinking about the power of land. My great friend, the activist Robbie Thorpe, when he talks about land rights, he says it's not land rights for people, it's the right of the land. We are there to serve the land, not land serve us. So our responsibility to country is first and foremost. And if we allow Aboriginal people to get on with caring for country in that way, we can rejuvenate country. So that was important for me to recognise, as degraded as this place is, it's still there. It's still there, and it was giving Odette strength and it still gives us strength.
Mm. And, you know, you've written about rivers and you've written about water across a lot of your work, and even in the absence of that water, this was still a book that I think really was energized by that presence and by that continuity and just the unkillability of our connection and of our, you know, of our ancestors and the creator spirits that carved out that earth and those waterways and are still there and still present, even with, as this describes, all of the horrors that occur on that country. I love this book. I have read it a few times now, and I think it is a really sad and at times very painful exploration of a deeply intimate part of so many Aboriginal people's history. But I hate this idea of like what's essential reading. This should be essential. This should be a responsibility. This is a shared history. And I commend you for writing it. And I just really encourage everyone, physically read the book if you can. It's out from University of Queensland Queensland Press, but also listen to Sharina's beautiful reading of it, yeah. Beautiful recording.
I was lucky enough to meet her. She's amazing.
Oh, she's so deadly. My last question to you before we wrap up is, can you just tell us a little bit about what you've got coming up next and what your next projects are?
Well, I've retired from my day job, so I've left academia, which is it's like getting out of life sentence from Pentridge, yeah, solitary confinement. So I have two books coming out next year. I have a poetry collection with University of Queensland Press, as you do, Evelyn.
I do.
Mine is called Whisper Songs. What is yours called?
Mine is called Drop Bear. As you know, because you mentored me in writing.
And I have a collection of short stories called Dark as Last Night, which is also coming out next year. And so what I'm doing at the moment is clearing the decks of any sort of hangover from academic life and sort of winding up and thinking about what I might do writing next year. And I'm up in the air about whether do I want to go hard or soft. So do I want to write something soft and loving or something hard? And I think I'll probably end up going hard, but we'll see what happens. I'm a grandfather now. I'm getting softer.
You've got two little grannies to look after. I reckon we're getting a combination. I'm just putting my bet in. So anyone who wants to meet my bet with that, just hit me up, let me know. But I'm so keen to see what you've got coming out next year and what you keep writing. Thank you so much for writing this, and thank you to the Sydney Writers Festival for hosting this conversation, and big thanks to the University of Queensland Press for publishing this book, and also thank you to all of the incredible black women without whom we would never be here today. Oh, and thank you, Tony Birch.
Absolutely, and thank you very much. I got questions in this interview that really loved.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to subscribe to and rate our channel.